But Trantor? Where was the sense in that? Once they were on Trantor, Pellaret would find his way into the Galactic Library and would never emerge. With endless stacks of books, films, and recordings, with innumerable computerizations and symbolic representations, he would surely never want to leave. Besides that, Ebling Miss had once gone to Trantor in the Mule's time. The story was that he had found the location of the Second Foundation there and had died before he could reveal it. But then, so had Arkady Dorell, and she had succeeded in locating the Second Foundation. But the location she had found was on Terminus itself, and there the nest of Second Foundationers was wiped out. Wherever the Second Foundation was now would be elsewhere. So what more had Trantor to tell? If he were looking for the Second Foundation, it was best to go anywhere but Trantor. Besides that, what further plans Brano had, he did not know, but he was not in the mood to oblige her. Brano had been ecstatic, had she, about a trip to Trantor. Well, if Brano wanted Trantor, they were not going to Trantor. Anywhere else, but not Trantor. And, worn out, with the night verging toward dawn, Trevise fell at last into a fitful slumber. 11. Membrano had had a good day on the one following the arrest of Trevise. She had been extolled far beyond her deserts, and the incident was never mentioned. Nevertheless, she knew well that the Council would soon emerge from its paralysis and that questions would be raised. She would have to act quickly. So, putting a great many matters to one side, she pursued the matter of Trevise. At the time when Trevise and Pellaret were discussing Earth, Brano was facing Councilman Mun Lee Kampor in the mayoralty office. As he sat across the desk from her, perfectly at ease, she appraised him once again. He was smaller and slighter than Trevise and only 2 years older. Both were freshman councilmen, young and brash, and that must have been the only thing that held them together, for they were different in all other respects. Where Trevise seemed to radiate a glowering intensity, Kampor shone with an almost serene self-confidence. Perhaps it was his blonde hair and blue eyes, not at all common among foundationers. They lent him an almost feminine delicacy that, Brano judged, made him less attractive to women than Trevise was. He was clearly vain of his looks, though, and made the most of them, wearing his hair rather long and making sure that it was carefully waved. He wore a faint blue shadowing under his eyebrows to accentuate the eye color. Shadowing of various tints had become common among men these last 10 years. He was no womanizer. He lived sedately with his wife, but had not yet registered parental intent and was not known to have a clandestine second companion. That, too, was different from Trevise, who changed housemates as often as he changed the loudly colored sashes for which he was notorious. There was little about either young councilman that Codell's department had not uncovered, and Codell himself sat quietly in one corner of the room, exuding a comfortable good cheer as always. Brano said, "Councilman Kampor, you have done the Foundation good service, but unfortunately for yourself, it is not of the sort that can be praised in public or repaid in ordinary fashion." Kampor smiled. He had white and even teeth, and Brano idly wondered for one flashing moment if all the inhabitants of the Sirius sector looked like that. Kampor's tale of stemming from that particular, rather peripheral region went back to his maternal grandmother, who had also been blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and who had maintained that her mother was from the Sirius sector. According to Codell, however, there was no hard evidence in favor of that. Women being what they were, Codell had said, she might well have claimed distant and exotic ancestry to add to her glamour and her already formidable attractiveness. "Is that how women are?" Brano had asked dryly, and Codell had smiled and muttered that he was referring to ordinary women, of course. Kampor said, "It is not necessary that the people of the Foundation know of my service, only that you do." "I know, and I will not forget. What I also will not do is to let you assume that your obligations are now over. You have embarked on a complicated course, and you must continue. We want more about Trevise. I have told you all I know concerning him." "That may be what you would have me believe. That may even be what you truly believe yourself. Nevertheless, answer my questions. Do you know a gentleman named Janov Pellaret?" For just a moment, Kampor's forehead creased, then smoothed itself almost at once. He said carefully, "I might know him if I were to see him, but the name does not seem to cause any association within me." "He is a scholar." Kampor's mouth rounded into a rather contemptuous but unsounded O, as though he were surprised that the mayor would expect him to know scholars. Brano said, "Pellaret is an interesting person who, for reasons of his own, has the ambition of visiting Trantor. Councilman Trevise will accompany him. Now, since you have been a good friend of Trevise, and perhaps know his system of thinking, tell me, do you think Trevise will consent to go to Trantor?" Kampor said, If you see to it that Treviz gets on the ship, and if the ship is piloted to Trantor, what can he do but go there? Surely you don't suggest he will mutiny and take over the ship? You don't understand. He and Tellarat will be alone on the ship, and it will be Treviz at the controls. You're asking whether he would go voluntarily to Trantor? Yes, that is what I'm asking. Madam Mayor, how can I possibly know what he will do? Councilman Campor, you have been close to Treviz. You know his belief in the existence of the Second Foundation. Has he never spoken to you of his theories as to where it might exist, where it might be found? Never, Madam Mayor. Do you think he will find it? Campor chuckled. I think the Second Foundation, whatever it was, and however important it might have been, was wiped out in the time of Arcade Durell. I believe her story. Indeed. In that case, why did you betray your friend? If he were searching for something that does not exist, what harm could he have done by propounding his quaint theories? Campor said, It is not the truth alone that can harm. His theories may have been merely quaint, but they might have succeeded in unsettling the people of Terminus, and by introducing doubts and fears as to the Foundation's role in the great drama of galactic history, have weakened its leadership of the Federation and its dreams of a second galactic empire. Clearly, you thought this yourself, or you would not have seized him on the floor of the Council, and you would not now be forcing him into exile without trial. Why have you done so, if I may ask, Mayor? Shall we say that I was cautious enough to wonder if there were some faint chance that he might be right, and that the expression of his views might be actively and directly dangerous? Campor said nothing. Brenna said, I agree with you, but I am forced by the responsibilities of my position to consider the possibility. Let me ask you again, if you have any indication as to where he might think the Second Foundation exists, and where he might go?
I have none.
He has never given you any hints in that direction?
No, of course not.
Never? Don't dismiss the thought easily. Think, never?
Never, said Campor firmly.
No hints, no joking remarks, no doodles, no thoughtful abstractions at moments that achieve significance as you look back on them?
None. I tell you, Madam Mayor, his dreams of the Second Foundation are the most nebulous starshine. You know it, and you but waste your time and your emotions in your concern over it.
You are not by some chance suddenly changing sides again and protecting the friend you delivered into my hands?
No, said Campor. I turned him over to you for what seemed to me to be good and patriotic reasons. I have no reason to regret the action or to change my attitude.
Then you can give me no hint as to where he might go once he has a ship at his disposal?
As I have already said, and yet, Councilman, and here the lines of the mayor's face so folded as to make her seem wistful,
I would like to know where he goes.
In that case, I think you ought to place a hyper relay on his ship.
I have thought of that, Councilman. He is, however, a suspicious man, and I suspect he will find it, however cleverly it might be placed. Of course, it might be placed in such a way that he cannot remove it without crippling the ship, and he might therefore be forced to leave it in place.
An excellent notion.
Except that, said Brano, he would then be inhibited. He might not go where he would go if he felt himself free and untrammeled. The knowledge I would gain would be useless to me.
In that case, it appears you cannot find out where he will go.
I might, for I intend to be very primitive. A person who expects the completely sophisticated and who guards against it is quite apt never to think of the primitive. I'm thinking of having Treviz followed.
Followed?
Exactly. By another pilot in another spaceship. See how astonished you are at the thought? He would be equally astonished. He might not think of scouring space for an accompanying mass. And, in any case, we will see to it that his ship is not equipped with our latest mass detection devices.
Campor said, Madam Mayor, I speak with all possible respect, but I must point out that you lack experience in spaceflight. To have one ship followed by another is never done, because it won't work. Treviz will escape with the first hyperspatial jump. Even if he doesn't know he is being followed, that first jump will be his path to freedom. If he doesn't have a hyper relay on board ship, he can't be traced.
I admit my lack of experience. Unlike you and Treviz, I have had no naval training. Nevertheless, I am told by my advisors, who have had such training, that if a ship is observed immediately prior to a jump, its direction, speed, and acceleration make it possible to guess what the jump might be in a general way. Given a good computer and an excellent sense of judgment, a follower might duplicate the jump closely enough to pick up the trail at the other end, especially if the follower has a good mass detector.
That might happen once, said Campor energetically, even twice if the follower is very lucky. But that's it. You can't rely on such things.
Perhaps we can. Councilman Campor, you have hyper-raced in your time. You see, I know a great deal about you.
You are an excellent pilot and have done amazing things when it comes to following a competitor through a jump.
Compor's eyes widened. He almost squirmed in his chair.
I was in college then. I am older now.
Not too old. Not yet 35. Consequently, you are going to follow Trevise, Councilman. Where he goes, you will follow, and you will report back to me. You will leave soon after Trevise does, and he will be leaving in a few hours. If you refuse the task, Councilman, you will be imprisoned for treason. If you take the ship that we will provide for you, and if you fail to follow, you need not bother coming back. You will be shot out of space if you try.
Copper rose sharply to his feet. I have a life to live. I have work to do. I have a wife. I cannot leave it all.
You will have to. Those of us who choose to serve the Foundation must be prepared at all times to serve it in a prolonged and uncomfortable fashion, if that should become necessary.
My wife must go with me, of course.
Do you take me for an idiot? She stays here, of course.
As a hostage?
If you like the word. I prefer to say that you will be taking yourself into danger, and my kind heart wants her to stay here where she will not be in danger. There is no room for discussion. You are as much under arrest as Trevise is, and I am sure you understand I must act quickly, before the euphoria enveloping Terminus wears off. I fear my star will soon be in the descendant.
12. Goodell said, "You were not easy on him, Madam Mayor." The mayor said with a sniff,
"Why should I have been? He betrayed a friend."
"That was useful to us."
"Yes, as it happened. His next betrayal, however, might not be."
"Why should there be another?"
"Come, Leono," said Brano impatiently. "Don't play games with me. Anyone who displays a capacity for double-dealing must forever be suspected of being capable of displaying it again."
"He may use the capability to combine with Trevise once again. Together they may..."
"You don't believe that. With all his folly and naivete, Trevise goes straight for his goal. He does not understand betrayal, and he will never, under any circumstances, trust Compor a second time."
Goodell said, "Pardon me, Mayor, but let me make sure I follow your thinking. How far, then, can you trust Compor? How do you know he will follow Trevise and report honestly? Do you count on his fears for the welfare of his wife as a restraint, his longing to return to her?"
"Both are factors. But I don't entirely rely on that. On Compor's ship, there will be a hyper-relay. Trevise would suspect pursuit and would search for one. However, Compor, being the pursuer, will, I assume, not suspect pursuit and will not search for one. Of course, if he does, and if he finds it, then we must depend on the attractions of his wife."
Cadell laughed. "To think I once had to give you lessons. And the purpose of the pursuit?"
"A double layer of protection. If Trevise is caught, it may be that Compor will carry on and give us the information that Trevise will not be able to."
"One more question. What if by some chance Trevise finds the Second Foundation and we learn of it through him, or through Compor, if we gain reason to suspect its existence, despite the deaths of both?"
"I'm hoping the Second Foundation does exist, Leono," she said. "In any case, the Selden plan is not going to serve us much longer. The great Harry Selden devised it in the dying days of the Empire, when technological advance had virtually stopped. Selden was a product of his times, too, and however brilliant this semi-mythical science of psychohistory must have been, it could not rise out of its roots. It surely would not allow for rapid technological advance. The Foundation has been achieving that, especially in this last century. We have mass detection devices of a kind undreamed of earlier, computers that can respond to thought, and most of all, mental shielding. The Second Foundation cannot control us for much longer if they can do so now. I want, in my final years in power, to be the one to start Terminus on a new path."
"And if there is, in fact, no Second Foundation?"
"Then we start on a new path at once."
13. The troubled sleep that had finally come to Trevise did not last long. A touch on his shoulder was repeated a second time. Trevise started up, bleary and utterly failing to understand why he should be in a strange bed.
What?
Tallarat said to him apologetically.
"I'm sorry, Councilman Trevise. You are my guest and I owe you rest, but the mayor is here."
He was standing at the side of the bed in flannel pajamas and shivering slightly. Trevise's senses leaped to a weary wakefulness, and he remembered. The mayor was in Tallarat's living room, looking as composed as always. Cadell was with her, rubbing lightly at his white mustache. Trevise adjusted his sash to the proper snugness and wondered how long the two of them, Brano and Cadell, were ever apart. Trevise said mockingly, "Has the council recovered yet? Are its members concerned over the absence of one of them?" The mayor said,
"There are signs of life, yes, but not enough to do you any good. There is no question but that I still have the power to force you to leave.
You will be taken to Ultimate Spaceport. Not Terminus Spaceport, Madam Mayor? Am I to be deprived of a proper farewell from weeping thousands? I see you have recovered your penchant for teenage silliness, Councilman, and I am pleased. It stills what might otherwise be a certain rising twinge of conscience. At Ultimate Spaceport, you and Professor Palarat will leave quietly. And never return. And perhaps never return. Of course, and here she smiled briefly, if you discover something of so great an importance and usefulness that even I will be glad to have you back with your information, you will return. You may even be treated with honor. Trevise nodded casually. That may happen. Almost anything may happen. In any case, you will be comfortable. You are being assigned a recently completed pocket cruiser, the Far Star, named for Hober Mallow's cruiser. One person can handle it, though it will hold as many as three with reasonable comfort. Trevise was jolted out of his carefully assumed mood of light irony. Fully armed? Unarmed, but otherwise fully equipped. Wherever you go, you will be citizens of the Foundation, and there will always be a consul to whom you can turn, so you will not require arms. You will be able to draw on funds at need, not unlimited funds, I might add. You are generous. I know that, Councilman. But, Councilman, understand me. You are helping Professor Palarat search for Earth. Whatever you think you are searching for, you are searching for Earth. All whom you meet must understand that, and always remember that the Far Star is not armed. I am searching for Earth, said Trevise. I understand that perfectly. Then you will go now. Pardon me, but surely there is more to all of this than we have discussed. I have piloted ships in my time, but I have no experience with a late-model pocket cruiser. What if I cannot pilot it? I am told that the Far Star is thoroughly computerized, and before you ask, you don't have to know how to handle a late-model ship's computer. It will itself tell you anything you need to know. Is there anything else you need? Trevise looked down at himself ruefully. A change of clothing. You will find them on board ship, including those girdles you wear, or sashes, whichever they are called. The professor is also supplied with what he needs. Everything reasonable is already aboard, although I hasten to add that this does not include female companions. Too bad, said Trevise. It would be pleasant. But then, I have no likely candidate at the moment, as it happens. Still, I presume the galaxy is populous, and that once away from here I may do as I please. With regard to companions, suit yourself. She rose heavily. I will not take you to the spaceport, she said, but there are those who will, and you must make no effort to do anything you are not told to do. I believe they will kill you if you make an effort to escape. The fact that I will not be with them will remove any inhibition. Trevise said, I will make no unauthorized effort, Madam Mayor. But one thing. Yes? Trevise searched his mind rapidly and finally said with a smile that he very much hoped looked unforced. The time may come, Madam Mayor, when you will ask me for an effort. I will then do as I choose, but I will remember the past 2 days. Mayor Brano sighed. Spare me the melodrama. If the time comes, it will come. But for now, I am asking for nothing. Chapter 4. Space. 14. The ship looked even more impressive than Trevise, with his memories of the time when the new cruiser class had been glowingly publicized, had expected. It was not the size that was impressive, for it was rather small. It was designed for maneuverability and speed, for totally gravitic engines, and most of all, for advanced computerization. It didn't need size. Size would have defeated its purpose. It was a one-man device that could replace with advantage the older ships that required a crew of a dozen or more. With a second or even a third person to establish shifts of duty, one such ship could fight off a flotilla of much larger non-Foundation ships. In addition, it could outspeed and escape from any other ship in existence. There was a sleekness about it, not a wasted line, not a superfluous curve inside or out. Every cubic meter of volume was used to its maximum, so as to leave a paradoxical aura of spaciousness within. Nothing the mayor might have said about the importance of his mission could have impressed Trevise more than the ship with which he was asked to perform it. Brano the Bronze, he thought with chagrin, had maneuvered him into a dangerous mission of the greatest significance. He might not have accepted with such determination had she not so arranged matters that he wanted to show her what he could do. As for Palarat, he was transported with wonder. Would you believe, he said, placing a gentle finger on the hull before he had climbed inside, that I've never been close to a spaceship? I'll believe it, of course, if you say so, Professor. But how did you manage it? I scarcely know, to be honest with you, dear Phil. I mean, my dear Trevise. I presume I was overly concerned with my research. When one's home has a really excellent computer capable of reaching other computers anywhere in the galaxy, one scarcely needs to budge, you know. Somehow I expected spaceships to be larger than this. This is a small model, but even so, it's much larger inside than any other ship of this size.
How can that be? You are making fun of my ignorance.
No, I'm serious. This is one of the first ships to be completely graviticized.
What does that mean?
Please don't explain if it requires extensive physics. I will take your word, as you took mine yesterday, in connection with the single species of humanity and the single world of origin. Let's try, Professor Pellerat. Through all the thousands of years of spaceflight, we've had chemical motors and ionic motors and hyperatomic motors, and all these things have been bulky. The old Imperial Navy had ships 500 meters long with no more living space in them than would fit into a small apartment. Fortunately, the Foundation has specialized in miniaturization through all the centuries of its existence, thanks to its lack of material resources. This ship is the culmination. It makes use of anti-gravity, and the device that makes that possible takes up virtually no space and is actually included in the hull. If it weren't that we still need the hyperatomic... A security guard approached. You'll have to get on, gentlemen. The sky was growing light, though sunrise was still half an hour off. Treves looked about. Is my baggage loaded? Yes, Councilman. You will find the ship fully equipped. With clothing, I suppose, that is not my size or to my taste. The guard smiled, quite suddenly and almost boyishly. I think it is, he said. The mayor had us working overtime these last 30 or 40 hours, and we've matched what you had closely. Money no object. Listen. He looked about, as though to make sure no one noticed his sudden fraternization. You two are lucky. Best ship in the world, fully equipped, except for armament. You're swimming in cream.
Sour cream, possibly, said Treves.
Well, Professor, are you ready?
With this I am,
Pellerat said, and held up a square wafer about 20 centimeters to the side and encased in a jacket of silvery plastic. Treves was suddenly aware that Pellerat had been holding it since they had left his home, shifting it from hand to hand and never putting it down, even when they had stopped for a quick breakfast.
What's that, Professor?
My library. It's indexed by subject matter and origin, and I've gotten it all into one wafer. If you think this ship is a marvel, how about this wafer? A whole library. Everything I have collected. Wonderful, wonderful.
Well, said Treves, we are swimming in cream. 15. Treves marveled at the inside of the ship. The utilization of space was ingenious. There was a storeroom with supplies of food, clothing, films, and games. There was a gym, a parlor, and two nearly identical bedrooms. This one, said Treves, must be yours, Professor. At least it contains an FX reader.
Good, said Pellerat with satisfaction. What an ass I have been to avoid spaceflight as I have. I could live here, my dear Treves, in utter satisfaction.
Roomier than I expected, said Treves with pleasure.
And the engines are really in the hull, as you said?
The controlling devices are, at any rate. We don't have to store fuel or make use of it on the spot. We're making use of the fundamental energy store of the universe, so that the fuel and the engines are all out there. He gestured vaguely.
Well, now that I think of it, what if something goes wrong?
Treves shrugged. I've been trained in space navigation, but not on these ships. If something goes wrong with the gravitics, I'm afraid there's nothing I can do about it.
But can you run the ship, pilot it?
I'm wondering that myself, Pellerat said.
Do you suppose this is an automated ship? Might we not merely be passengers? We might simply be expected to sit here.
They have such things in the case of ferries between planets and space stations within a stellar system, but I never heard of automated hyperspace travel. At least, not so far. Not so far. He looked about again, and there was a trickle of apprehension within him. Had that Harridan mayor managed to maneuver that far ahead of him? Had the Foundation automated interstellar travel, too, and was he going to be deposited on Trantor quite against his will and with no more to say about it than any of the rest of the furniture aboard ship? He said with a cheerful animation he didn't feel, Professor, you sit down. The mayor said this ship was completely computerized. If your room has the FX reader, mine ought to have a computer in it. Make yourself comfortable and let me look around a bit on my own. Pellerat looked instantly anxious.
Treves, my dear chap, you're not getting off the ship, are you?
Not my plan at all, Professor. And if I tried, you can count on my being stopped. It is not the mayor's intention to allow me off. All I'm planning to do is to learn what operates the Far Star. He smiled. I won't desert you, Professor. He was still smiling as he entered what he felt to be his own bedroom, but his face grew sober as he closed the door softly behind him. Surely there must be some means of communicating with a planet in the neighborhood of the ship. It was impossible to imagine a ship deliberately sealed off from its surroundings, and therefore somewhere, perhaps in a wall recess, there would have to be a reacher. He could use it to call the mayor's office to ask about controls. Carefully, he inspected the walls, the headboard of the bed, and the neat, smooth furniture. If nothing turned up here, he would go through the rest of the ship. He was about to turn away when his eye caught a glint of light on the smooth, light brown surface of the desk. A round circle of light with neat lettering that read, Computer Instructions. Ah! Nevertheless, his heart beat rapidly. There were computers and computers, and there were programs that took a long time to master. Trevise had never made the mistake of underestimating his own intelligence, but on the other hand, he was not a grand master. There were those who had a knack for using a computer and those who had not, and Trevise knew very well into which class he fell. In his hitch in the Foundation Navy, he had reached the rank of lieutenant, and had on occasion been officer of the day, and had had occasion to use the ship's computer. He had never been in sole charge of it, however, and he had never been expected to know anything more than the routine maneuvers being officer of the day required. He remembered with a sinking feeling the volumes taken up by a fully described program in printout, and he could recall the behavior of Technical Sergeant Krasnet at the console of the ship's computer. He played it as though it were the most complex musical instrument in the galaxy, and did it all with an air of nonchalance, as though we were bored at its simplicity. Yet even he had had to consult the volumes at times, swearing at himself in embarrassment. Hesitantly, Trevise placed a finger on the circle of light, and at once the light spread out to cover the desktop. On it were the outline of two hands, a right and a left. With a sudden, smooth movement, the desktop tilted to an angle of 45 degrees. Trevise took the seat before the desk. No words were necessary. It was clear what he was expected to do. He placed his hands on the outlines on the desk, which were positioned for him to do so without strain. The desktop seemed soft, nearly velvety where he touched it, and his hands sank in. He stared at his hands with astonishment, for they had not sunk in at all. They were on the surface, his eyes told him. Yet to his sense of touch, it was as though the desk surface had given way, and as though something were holding his hands softly and warmly. Was that all? Now what? He looked about, and then closed his eyes in response to a suggestion. He had heard nothing. He had heard nothing. But inside his brain, as though it were a vagrant thought of his own, there was the sentence, Please close your eyes, relax, we will make connection. Through the hands? Somehow, Trevise had always assumed that if one were going to communicate by thought with a computer, it would be through a hood placed over the head and with electrodes against the eyes and skull. The hands? But why not the hands? Trevise found himself floating away, almost drowsy, but with no loss of mental acuity. Why not the hands? The eyes were no more than sense organs. The brain was no more than a central switchboard encased in bone and removed from the working surface of the body. It was the hands that were the working surface, the hands that felt and manipulated the universe. Human beings thought with their hands. It was their hands that were the answer of curiosity, that felt and pinched and turned and lifted and hefted. There were animals that had brains of respectable size, but they had no hands, and that made all the difference. And as he and the computer held hands, their thinking merged, and it no longer mattered whether his eyes were open or closed. Opening them did not improve his vision, nor did closing them dim it. Either way, he saw the room with complete clarity, not just in the direction in which he was looking, but all around and above and below. He saw every room in the spaceship, and he saw outside as well. The sun had risen, and its brightness was dimmed in the morning mist, but he could look at it directly without being dazzled, for the computer automatically filtered the light waves. He felt the gentle wind and its temperature and the sounds of the world about him. He detected the planet's magnetic field and the tiny electrical charges on the wall of the ship. He became aware of the controls of the ship without even knowing what they were in detail. He knew only that if he wanted to lift the ship or turn it or accelerate it or make use of any of its abilities, the process was the same as that of performing the analogous process to his body. He had but to use his will. Yet his will was not unalloyed. The computer itself could override. At the present moment, there was a formed sentence in his head, and he knew exactly when and how the ship would take off. There was no flexibility where that was concerned. Thereafter, he knew just as surely he would himself be able to decide. He found, as he cast the net of his computer-enhanced consciousness outward, that he could sense the condition of the upper atmosphere, that he could see the weather patterns. that he could detect the other ships that were swarming upward and the others that were settling downward. All of this had to be taken into account, and the computer was taking it into account. If the computer had not been doing so, Trevise realized, he need only desire the computer to do so, and it would be done. So much for the volumes of programming. There were none. Trevise thought of Technical Sergeant Krasnet and smiled. He had read often enough of the immense revolution that gravitics would make in the world, but the fusion of computer and mind was still a state secret. It would surely produce a still greater revolution. He was aware of time passing. He knew exactly what time it was by Terminus Local and by Galactic Standard. How did he let go? And even as the thought entered his mind, his hands were released, and the desktop moved back to its original position, and Trevise was left with his own unaided senses. He felt blind and helpless, as though for a time he had been held and protected by a superbeing, and now was abandoned. Had he not known that he could make contact again at any time, the feeling might have reduced him to tears. As it was, he merely struggled for reorientation, for adjustment to limits, then rose uncertainly to his feet and walked out of the room. Pellaret looked up. He had adjusted his reader, obviously, and he said, "It works very well. It has an excellent search program. Did you find the controls, my boy?" "Yes, Professor, all is well." "In that case, shouldn't we do something about takeoff? I mean, self-protection? Aren't we supposed to strap ourselves in or something? I looked about for instructions, but I didn't find anything, and that made me nervous. I had to turn to my library. Somehow, when I am at my work..." Trevise had been pushing his hands at the professor as though to dam and stop the flood of words. Now he had to speak loudly in order to override him. "None of that is necessary, Professor. Antigravity is the equivalent of non-inertia. There is no feeling of acceleration when velocity changes, since everything on the ship undergoes the change simultaneously."
"You mean we won't know when we are off the planet and out in space?"
"That's exactly what I mean, because even as I speak to you, we have taken off. We will be cutting through the upper atmosphere in a very few minutes, and within half an hour we will be in outer space." 16. Pellaret seemed to shrink a little as he stared at Trevise. His long rectangle of a face grew so blank that, without showing any emotion at all, it radiated a vast uneasiness. Then his eyes shifted right, left. Trevise remembered how he had felt on his own first trip beyond the atmosphere. He said, in as matter-of-fact a manner as he could, "Janoff..." It was the first time he had addressed the professor familiarly, but in this case experience was addressing inexperience, and it was necessary to seem the older of the two. "We are perfectly safe here. We are in the metal womb of a warship of the Foundation Navy. We are not fully armed, but there is no place in the galaxy where the name of the Foundation will not protect us. Even if some ship went mad and attacked, we could move out of its reach in a moment. And I assure you, I have discovered that I can handle the ship perfectly." Pellaret said,
"It's the thought, Golan, of nothingness."
"Why, there's nothingness all about Terminus. There's just a thin layer of very tenuous air between ourselves on the surface and the nothingness just above. All we're doing is to go past that inconsequential layer."
"It may be inconsequential, but we breathe it."
"We breathe here, too. The air on this ship is cleaner and purer, and will indefinitely remain cleaner and purer than the natural atmosphere of Terminus."
"And the meteorites?"
"What about meteorites?"
"The atmosphere protects us from meteorites. Radiation, too, for that matter."
Trevise said, "Humanity has been traveling through space for 20 millennia, I believe."
22. If we go by the Helblachian chronology, it is quite plain that count..."
"Enough. Have you heard of meteorite accidents or of radiation deaths, recently? I mean, in the case of Foundation ships?"
"I have not really followed the news in such matters, but I am a historian, my boy, and..."
"Historically, yes, there have been such things. But technology improves. There isn't a meteorite large enough to damage us that can possibly approach us before we can take the necessary evasive action. 4 meteorites coming at us simultaneously from the 4 directions drawn from the vertices of a tetrahedron might conceivably pin us down. But calculate the chances of that, and you'll find that you'll die of old age a trillion trillion times over before you will have a 50-50 chance of observing so interesting a phenomenon."
"You mean if you were at the computer?"
"No," said Trevise in scorn. "If I were running the computer on the basis of my own senses and responses, we would be hit before I ever knew what was happening. It's the computer itself that is at work, responding millions of times faster than you or I could." He held out his hand abruptly. "Janoff, come, let me show you what the computer can do, and let me show you what space is like." Pellaret stared, goggling a bit. Then he laughed briefly.
"I'm not sure I wish to know, Golan."
Of course you're not sure, Genoff, because you don't know what it is that is waiting there to be known. Chance it. Come, into my room. Trevise held the other's hand, half leading him, half drawing him. He said as he sat down at the computer, "Have you ever seen the galaxy, Genoff? Have you ever looked at it?" Pellaret said, "You mean in the sky?" "Yes, certainly. Where else?" "I've seen it. Everyone has seen it. If one looks up, one sees it." "Have you ever stared at it on a dark, clear night when the diamonds are below the horizon?" The diamonds referred to those few stars that were luminous enough and close enough to shine with moderate brightness in the night sky of Terminus. They were a small group that spanned a width of no more than 20 degrees, and for large parts of the night, they were all below the horizon. Aside from the group, there was a scattering of dim stars just barely visible to the unaided eye. There was nothing more but the faint milkiness of the galaxy, the view one might expect when one dwelt on a world like Terminus, which was at the extreme edge of the outermost spiral of the galaxy.
"I suppose so, but why stare? It's a common sight."
"Of course it's a common sight," said Trevise. "That's why no one sees it. Why see it if you can always see it? But now you'll see it, and not from Terminus, where the mist and the clouds are forever interfering. You'll see it as you'd never see it from Terminus, no matter how you stared, and no matter how clear and dark the night. How I wish I had never been in space before, so that, like you, I could see the galaxy in its bare beauty for the first time." He pushed a chair in Pellaret's direction. "Sit there, Genoff. This may take a little time. I have to continue to grow accustomed to the computer. From what I've already seen, I know the viewing is holographic, so we won't need a screen of any sort. It makes direct contact with my brain, but I think I can have it produce an objective image that you will see, too. Put out the light, will you?" "No, that's foolish of me. I'll have the computer do it. Stay where you are." Trevise made contact with the computer, holding hands warmly and intimately. The light dimmed, then went out completely, and in the darkness, Pellaret stirred. Trevise said, "Don't get nervous, Genoff. I may have a little trouble trying to control the computer, but I'll start easy, and you'll have to be patient with me. Do you see it? The crescent?" It hung in the darkness before them, a little dim and wavering at first, but getting sharper and brighter. Pellaret's voice sounded odd. "Is that Terminus? Are we that far from it?" "Yes, the ship's moving quickly." The ship was curving into the night shadow of Terminus, which appeared as a thick crescent of bright light. Trevise had a momentary urge to send the ship in a wide arc that would carry them over the daylight side of the planet to show it in all its beauty, but he held back. Pellaret might find novelty in this, but the beauty would be tame. There were too many photographs, too many maps, too many globes. Every child knew what Terminus looked like. A water planet, more so than most, rich in water and poor in minerals, good in agriculture and poor in heavy industry, but the best in the galaxy in high technology and in miniaturization. If he could have the computer use microwaves and translate it into a visible model, they would see every one of Terminus's 10,000 inhabited islands, together with the only one of them large enough to be considered a continent, the one that bore Terminus City and... Turn away. It was just a thought, an exercise of the will, but the view shifted at once. The lighted crescent moved off toward the borders of vision and rolled off the edge. The darkness of starless space filled his eyes. Pellaret cleared his throat. "I wish you would bring back Terminus, my boy. I feel as though I've been blinded." There was tightness in his voice. "You're not blind. Look." Into the field of vision came a filmy fog of pale translucence. It spread and became brighter until the whole room seemed to glow. Shrink. Another exercise of will, and the galaxy drew off, as though seen through a diminishing telescope that was steadily growing more powerful in its ability to diminish. The galaxy contracted and became a structure of varying luminosity. Brighten. It grew more luminous without changing size, and because the stellar system to which Terminus belonged was above the galactic plane, the galaxy was not seen exactly edge-on. It was a strongly foreshortened double spiral with curving dark nebula rifts streaking the glowing edge of the Terminus side. The creamy haze in the nucleus, far off and shrunken by the distance, looked unimportant. Pellaret said in an odd whisper, "You are right. I have never seen it like this. I never dreamed it had so much detail." "How could you? You can't see the outer half when Terminus's atmosphere is between you and it. You can hardly see the nucleus from Terminus's surface."
"What a pity we're seeing it so nearly head-on."
"We don't have to. The computer can show it in any orientation. I just have to express the wish, and not even aloud. Shift coordinates." This exercise of will was by no means a precise command. Yet, as the image of the galaxy began to undergo a slow change, his mind guided the computer and had it do what he wished. Slowly, the galaxy was turning so that it could be seen at right angles to the galactic plane.
It spread out like a gigantic, glowing whirlpool, with curves of darkness and knots of brightness, and a central, all but featureless blaze. Pellerat asked, "How can the computer see it from a position in space that must be more than 50,000 parsecs from this place?" Then he added in a choked whisper, "Please forgive me that I ask. I know nothing about all this." Treviz said, "I know almost as little about this computer as you do. Even a simple computer, however, can adjust coordinates and show the galaxy in any position, starting with what it can sense in the natural position, the one, that is, that would appear from the computer's local position in space. Of course, it makes use only of the information it can sense to begin with, so when it changes to the broadside view, we would find gaps and blurs in what it would show. In this case, though, yes, we have an excellent view. I suspect that the computer is outfitted with a complete map of the galaxy and can, therefore, view it from any angle with equal ease."
"How do you mean, a complete map?"
"The spatial coordinates of every star in it must be in the computer's memory banks."
"Every star?"
Pellerat seemed awed. "Well, perhaps not all 300 billion. It would include the stars shining down on populated planets, certainly, and probably every star of spectral class K and brighter. That means about 75 billion at least."
"Every star of a populated system?"
"Well, I wouldn't want to be pinned down, perhaps not all. There were, after all, 25 million inhabited systems in the time of Harry Seldon, which sounds like a lot, but is only one star out of every 12,000. And then, in the 5 centuries since Seldon, the general breakup of the empire didn't prevent further colonization. I should think it would have encouraged it. There are still plenty of habitable planets to expand into, so there may be 30 million now. It's possible that not all the new ones are in the Foundation's records."
"But the old ones? Surely they must all be there without exception."
"I imagine so. I can't guarantee it, of course, but I would be surprised if any long-established inhabited system were missing from the records. Let me show you something, if my ability to control the computer will go far enough." Treviz's hands stiffened a bit with the effort, and they seemed to sink further into the clasp of the computer. That might not have been necessary. He might only have had to think quietly and casually. Terminus. He did think that, and there was, in response, a sparkling red diamond at the very edge of the whirlpool. "There's our sun," he said with excitement. "That's the star that Terminus circles."
"Ah," said Pellerat with a low, tremulous sigh.
A bright yellow dot of light sprang into life in a rich cluster of stars deep in the heart of the galaxy, but well to one side of the central haze. It was rather closer to the Terminus edge of the galaxy than to the other side. "And that," said Treviz, "is Trantor's sun." Another sigh. Then Pellerat said,
"Are you sure? They always speak of Trantor as being located in the center of the galaxy."
"It is, in a way. It's as close to the center as a planet can get and still be habitable. It's closer than any other major populated system. The actual center of the galaxy consists of a black hole with a mass of nearly 1 million stars, so that the center is a violent place. As far as we know, there is no life in the actual center, and maybe there just can't be any life there. Trantor is in the innermost sub-ring of the spiral arms, and believe me, if you could see its night sky, you would think it was in the center of the galaxy. It's surrounded by an extremely rich clustering of stars.